Accession number 24193, reel 11.
Mr. Towle, reel 11. We're talking about the different types of patrol that we might undertake at night. We got on to the reconnaissance patrol and the importance of silent movement, different methods of slithering, getting forward, and also camouflage clothing. So what happened as you actually approached the area of interest or the Chinese-Korean lines?
I think you would freeze and move very, very slowly. As soon as you identified activity, which might just be a general movement, or it might be a sentry, it might be somebody using a latrine, and the idea was to be as quiet and as cautious and as careful as you possibly could be. You had a pair of binoculars, you would get as close as you could without giving the game away, and then you would lie, stay there, and observe the course of activity of the enemy. They might be cleaning weapons, they might be practicing weapon firing. Generally, though, the Chinese didn't do that. They cleaned weapons, they ate. They would seldom emerge outside their defensive positions except to move ammunition about, build some defenses on the surface of the earth. An awful lot of their defenses were, of course, burrowing into hillsides. Having confirmed that there were enemy there, whatever your mission was, you then sought to withdraw. Now, you could withdraw at night, going back, because often the return was as dangerous as the outward bound leg. You weren't looking towards the enemy as you returned, you were looking forward. There were minefields to observe. On one reconnaissance patrol, I remember very clearly Sergeant Bell of the Pioneer Platoon was with me, and we were looking at the ford, an underwater ford over the Samichon River, and whether it would, you know, it seemed firm enough to possibly take a tank. We observed the enemy. We were able to test the structure of the surface just under the water without being observed, and we then returned. On our way back, our road, for some reason, it was not possible for us to go back on our same course. And often you didn't return on the same course because you could well be ambushed if you were seen on the way out. So you would return on a slightly different course, but going towards your own lines. So I was leading Sergeant Bell with me, and he was there because of, A, the testing of the ford, and also he was looking at minefields because there'd been a changeover of many battalions in the area, and the minefield recording had got a bit slack. So I was leading, and we'd had some snow, about 2 or 3 inches on the ground, and I suddenly looked down and saw there were wires running along the top of the snow. So I said to Sergeant Bell, what do you think this is? And he said, oh, so that's all right. I laid this minefield some weeks ago, and I know where they are. Would you like me to go first? Because I know where they are. So I said, please be my guest. So we stepped cautiously over these wires, all of which were visible. And I think it was a moonlight return, and therefore you could see. And we stepped over these and got back and reported that indeed the village had activity in it by the ford, and we reported back. Incidentally, the follow-on to that was that the brigade headquarters, having had that information, we passed it up to our company commander. The company commander passed it on to battalion headquarters, and they sent it back to brigade. Brigade said it wasn't good enough. They wanted to send an engineer officer out to check the surface as to its viability to accept tanks. So I took a patrol out, and this is another form of reconnaissance patrol, where it isn't to observe enemy, but it's to get a professional to do a reconnaissance of the ground, the topography, to ensure that its use is suitable for what you had in mind. So I took two men out with me, and an engineer and the sappers, an officer, with some equipment and sticks and so on that he had. And same repeat, I took two soldiers, that's right, and the sapper officer. And we got out on patrol, got to the ford. The engineer, to my horror, wanted to cross over the river and check the other side, and my heart dropped. But we couldn't let him go by himself, so we crossed over. And quietly, the water was about, and it was water at that time. And it was the temperature was falling very fast indeed. The water was quite fast flowing, so we waded across. It was above knee level, but there was a bit of slipping and sliding. We got to the other side. The two soldiers and I had Sten guns. The engineer officer only had his pistol and his measuring devices. And he was measuring away on the enemy bank, and particularly the slope of the Samajon River. And he said, OK, well, I'm ready to go now. And at that moment, the enemy started shooting in our direction, because I think we'd splashed around a bit and we made a lot of noise. And by then, it had become intensely cold, and we were there actually probably a couple of hours. I couldn't think what the engineer was doing. So some soldiers came up to us. So I said, OK, I gave an order to fire. Nothing happened. All three of our stens had got wet, and the bolt, the block, was held back by ice, and nothing happened. You had to manually free it and then fire. So we fired like hell at anything that we could see, with no accuracy at all, and got back in two pieces. One soldier went back with the sapper officer on the other side, and I withdrew back. And when we were withdrawing, the other two, having got to the other bank, fired. So we had a bit of continuous fire. And to be quite frank, we ran as hard as we could down a track, because by then it was known we were in the area, and we wanted to get out and away as fast as possible. Anyway, we got back and found that the Ford was, according to the engineer, not suitable for Centurion tanks of that time, with its 20-pounder gun, and it was just too heavy. So a possible attack was not carried through in that area, because we could not have armor support. And in fact, no major attack by us was launched in that area, because the ground was too soft, even in winter. And so that was really quite useful. I think the other patrol then was the fighting patrol, and this is a much more serious event. It is not ordered by a company commander. And here what would happen, talking about O groups, is a company commander would be ordered, he would attend an O group with the battalion commander, and the battalion commander would say, we've been ordered to secure some prisoners. And the company commander would then discuss this with the battalion commander and the heads of the mortar division, the machine gun division, the artillery officer, the forward observation officer, which would be in attendance at the battalion headquarters. And the mission of the patrol was decided. The colonel would discuss, like, we need to identify the unit opposite us. Is it North Korean? Is it Chinese? What is it? How long have they been in the line? And we need prisoners to tell us this information. At that order group, the colonel would decide as to which company would provide the fighting patrol. A very important issue. And there'd be a sort of record kept in the war room, the battle group, as it was called, as to who had actually been out before, had D Company or C Company had a little bit of a rest from a fighting patrol, particularly if there were casualties, which there generally were at a fighting patrol. And let's assume in this case that the C Company commander, Hubert Holden, a wonderful, wonderful officer and a holder of the Military Cross from World War II, which was very much an achievement, would come back. He would call then his own order group with his platoon commanders and sergeant major of the company, and I would go to that meeting, and he would outline the mission. You talk about administrative issues, how is the food supply, how is ammunition, how is wiring, how are batteries for radios, terribly important. How is the morale of the men? Is it good, bad, indifferent? And if it's the latter two, well, what are you doing about it, and what can we do about it? Is rest and recuperation, the 5 days R&R program, being implemented? Do people like it and enjoy it and so on? Have they had a wash recently? Any frostbite? Any health problems? Right, and having got those out of the way, then the mission would be discussed. It would be a fighting patrol in this area against probably this hill where there's known to be enemy activity. And it should be a fighting patrol. The enemy, from intelligence, seems to have some machine guns in this area and a number of men. Therefore, it should be a big, biggish fighting patrol. Maybe an officer and 10 to 15 soldiers, but well armed with Bren guns and hand grenades. And now, who's going to do it? There were three officers from each of the three platoons. Well, I went last time, somebody else said, well, no, I went the time before, and it seems that the person who hasn't been out for two fighting patrols in a row would, by common sense, it would be his turn, and let's assume that was my turn. I would then receive the mission. You would probably have 24 hours notice for a fighting patrol, like in the afternoon of the day before the fighting patrol, but sometimes the same day. Mission, timing, defensive fire tasks would be worked out. When you go out on patrol, you're going to go to this area, you're going to actually make an aggressive move against the enemy, hope to seize prisoners, then withdraw, and have your withdrawal covered by defensive fire tasks of machine gun fire from the Vickers, overhead or to your flanks, or mortar fire, or distraction harassing fire from artillery, the 25-pounders, while the battle is going on, after the battle, to harass and confuse the enemy. These were always great events in the life of a platoon. Nobody liked it, but nobody refused to go, ever. You would call for volunteers. No, Private so-and-so, thank you for volunteering, but through his section commander. But he went on the last one, and we'd like to ensure that there's a fair rota, and I think the soldiers liked the fairness of the deal. And if you'd been out on a patrol the night before, of any of them, listening or reconnaissance, you would automatically be excluded from this fighting patrol. You would then elect the composition of the fighting patrol.
So would they all be volunteers then? I mean, would you always get enough volunteers, or was it a case of you and you at the end of it?
At the end of the day, I think you would have some volunteers, but you would then make a decision. Well, thank you for volunteering, but you did it last time, and you generally ordered a number of soldiers to go, and often it would go down, and it would go like this. We need 10 soldiers out of our 30 on the hill. Therefore, we will need 3 from each section. That would be the 9, roughly, from the 3. And, okay, Corporal so-and-so, who do you think should go? And Corporal so-and-so would say, you know, Private A, B, and C. And Corporal so-and-so from the next section would reply. The sergeant would say, well, you know, he's got a wonky ankle, he's sprained it. Or so-and-so got a bad cut from a wiring party, and I don't think he should go. So one would take time in selecting the fittest possible fighting patrol, and it would be, generally speaking, officer-led. Then would come the... So you would make that decision of the components, the consistency of the fighting patrol. So you would say, right, for that order group, anything else, any other questions and so on, let's close down this order group. The three corporals, will you have your selections for the fighting patrol here in 2 hours' time when we will discuss the mission? And the nine men, let's say, which would include a corporal and a full corporal, would come from the platoon. We would then sit down and calmly and measuredly and jokingly, and humour played such an important part because it mitigated the fright and the scariness of the event. And you would make little jokes like, well, I hope Private John Smith doesn't rattle as he did on the last patrol and give the game away, and everybody would laugh and so on. So the mission would then be understood. You would try and often make a little sand model on the back of the hill as to, okay, we're going to go up this hill, which we believe is occupied. We think there is a machine gun post there and about, let's say, a dozen enemy. They seem to be sloppy in their operation. They go to the latrine. Maybe we could ambush one and just drag him. The mission is to get a prisoner. And this is what we'll do. And we would then make our own little plan between the nine soldiers, a corporal, 10, myself, an officer, 11, signaller with me, 12. And if this was not a multi-staged fighting patrol, by that having several firm bases, often a big fighting patrol would have the sharp end, the fighting end of the patrol, which would go from a firm base, which would be established in no man's land, which it can come back to, or seek support if it needs. And indeed, that firm base, let's call it firm base 2, might well have another firm base in no man's land, 300 or 400 yards behind it. So you could have a three-pronged or three-tiered fighting patrol. And indeed, in another part of the front, around Hill 355, I in fact was involved in one of those three-pronged attacks. They were complicated, cumbersome, because more troops were involved. But going to a single, simple fighting patrol, dress would be discussed, dress in the sense of...
So what would you wear? Tell me a bit more. We mentioned it before, but a bit more detail.
Bit more detail. You would wear as light equipment as you possibly could, making sure that it didn't rattle, it didn't glint, it was all dulled, and there were camouflage paints and so on readily available. No shiny bits on the weapons, no shiny bits on your face, on your hands. If it was winter, you would wear gloves, of course, and you would have a basic white uniform. But otherwise, you would have the American standard equipment, which was really a sort of camouflaged jumpsuit, simple pants, simple jackets, tending to blend of a greyish nature, but blending very well into the scrubby, rocky granite area of Korea, offset, of course, by the paddy fields, and if they were bright green, well, it was an olive drab colour, and it did just fit in. The officer's equipment would be, generally speaking, two or four grenades clipped generally to the back of your belt, because when you were on your tummy, which was most of the time, they wouldn't get in the way. And on your equipment, maybe two at the top here in the front. So you carry four of those. The choice was always, did you take a rifle, did you take just your pistol, or did you take a Sten gun? Most officers didn't carry a Sten gun because it's a bit cumbersome and a bit antiquated, and you had other things to do with your hands, like talk on the radio. Your operator would be three paces behind you. You may need to consult your map. And generally speaking, you weren't expected to, you know, to fix bayonets and charge. You had other responsibilities.
I think you were just going to say it actually. But what were the actual composition of weapons would the soldiers carry?
Right, the soldiers on a fighting patrol, you needed automatic power of a delivery to scatter an area with as heavy and as rapid a bullet cover as possible. Unfortunately, the British Army was not well equipped at that time for this sort of thing. One had the wonderful 303, which was an accurate rifle, but generally rather useless in what is going to be a close combat, close encounter with physical contact with the enemy. And you know, you might have a bayonet, and there are some occasions that could be scary and could be used, but generally speaking, not. So soldiers carried Sten guns and grenades almost exclusively, and of course the ubiquitous and most valuable Bren gun. And nobody went on a fighting patrol without one Bren gun, and a Bren gun team is of two, the ammunition loader and carrier, and the replacement to the Bren gun if there's a casualty. Now, nobody went on a fighting patrol without a Bren gun team or two. But they were heavy, and they were noisy, and they tended to slow things down. Sten guns were rattly and noisy, but could deliver a good rate of fire. I carried an American carbine, which had a good long magazine, not very accurate, but it would have put an amount of fire down, and a 45 automatic, which was a big slug of lead in the air, and very much better than our Smith & Wesson, I think it was, 38, which was notoriously inaccurate. So that's what we would have taken and worn on a fighting patrol. Of course, one would rehearse. Yeah, if we discuss the mission, we'd make a little model of it out of stones, and we'd try and indicate that, okay, we're going to get to this point, then the patrol will divide into two, and Corporal so-and-so is going to take four men round there, and I will have the balance here. And we will provide covering fire, for example, while Corporal so-and-so goes up with his team and looks around the trenches, tries to snatch somebody, and then come back. We don't want to get into a sustained battle of gunfire, but see somebody, wound them if possible, drag them, and carry them back. And the fighting patrols, other than the time it took to get there, were pretty fast events. It was a lot of preparation, a lot of planning. The hand signals were very important.
Tell me about them.
On the assumption you could see each other, which was, and they were generally at night. This was the norm. You could generally see each other. There was always light. And the distance between the soldiers was 3 to 5 yards, and you knew where people were. And the signals were, you know, you'd hold up your hand, and you'd hold one like this, which means the one behind you, and you point over there, and the soldiers would only ever go 5 yards. And then if you do it again, another 5 yards, and then you begin to lose control. Or you'd hold up two, and you'd point there, and then go to 5 yards, and then you'd tell them to go again. So these hand signals were very, and everybody knew them, and they would send messages back, like a lot of enemy in front.
That's just raising and lowering the arm.
Yes, you know, and you knew damn well that was, hey, there's some activity up there, worth reporting, and you then took action accordingly. They were scary. Lots of time was spent in waiting and listening and waiting, listening, and ambushing. Patrols often went, just a fighting patrol, to ambush. It was believed the enemy used a track to go between two hills. So you would set an ambush. And again, this would be rehearsed, and here was a crossroads in the tracks, and you would say, okay, well, there'd be three here, three over there, making sure they didn't shoot at each other when you fired. And certain soldiers were instructed to use their grenades when they were told to fire, rather than Sten guns, and some were told to use Stens and not grenades, and the Bren guns, of course, were to provide fire all the time. And they were only ever to fire on instructions from the leader of the patrol, and if the leader was incapacitated for whatever reason, then it was very clearly understood that Corporal so-and-so would be the commander, and every soldier knew that. We would have, before we went, little rehearsals to remind each other of the signals, and the freeze. Freeze was terribly important.
Can you just explain the freeze?
The freeze. The commander of a fighting patrol would never lead. He would be three back, probably, from, and it's often a single file through the paddy fields and so on. So you would send two scouts, as it were, ahead, not very far ahead, 10 yards ahead, and they would move cautiously, you would keep up with them, and suddenly they would hold up a hand like that, and then you would immediately repeat it, and it would go right the way back. And everybody would not throw themselves to the ground, they would just stand still, because getting to the ground can create a lot of noise and a lot of distraction, and you don't hear anything when you're moving to the ground, so you just stand. And it's a wonderful situation of strength, because you're ready, you know something is about to happen, and you're ready to go. And then, if you're ordered to the ground, it was very clearly this.
And indicating with your arm again.
Yes, again, with your arm. And often there'd be hand contact. If, you know, at the end of the line, the poor devil, number 12 or 15 or whatever, he was getting all these signals. By the time he got a signal to get down, everybody else was getting up. There were problems of that nature, which one handled. It was more difficult if you went into extended line, and you tend to lose control at night. And therefore, I found that very vulnerable and very worrying, because you're looking more towards, at least you should be, the enemy, rather than keeping your eye on your flanks. And they were always told to keep level. But and then the battle, you would go up to the hill. Often you find the enemy had gone, and so you withdraw. Sometimes we put booby traps in, simple booby traps.
So can you describe what type of booby trap?
Generally speaking, hand grenades with a wire. Very simple stuff. Sometimes you take explosive, but not often. But a hand grenade with the pin and a tripwire, which everybody carried, and that would be set up, and then you would withdraw. Several of those.
So if they tripped over the wire, it would pull the pin?
It would pull the pin, the lever would go down and strike the fuse, the percussion cap in the fuse, and the grenade would explode, and you would hear it. Often you would, if the enemy had withdrawn and they knew you were there, and then they came back, and maybe wanting to follow you, that could alert you that you're being followed. Sometimes you put flares as a trip. And that, again, was of a warning nature.